Okay, let's start. Can you hear me? Good, okay. So today we will talk about a bit more about C. And this is the agenda for today. First, we will talk about some differences between arrays and pointers. We will talk about how to use man page to look up something maybe you're trying to get some more information about. We will talk about how to use structures and dynamic allocation in C, and some undefined behavior you may see in your programs. So hopefully these will help you with your next assignments on lists. And if time permits, we will actually start talking about the instruction set architecture. So let's take a look at pointers versus arrays. So here I am declaring two things. One is the first one, A1. It is an array of integers and it has three elements. And the second one is just a pointer to an integer, a 2. So can you tell me what would be the size of A1 and A2 in bytes? I thought I see some hands. Yes.
So A1 is essentially also like a pointer.
So no, actually, but yes.
Do you mean the amount of memory like that's allocated for that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then it would be, how much is 64 divided by 8?
So let's assume an integer is 4 bytes. Okay, yeah, let's see. So first one. So this is A1, and basically it's saying that we will have space for three integers, and assuming that the integers are 4 bytes, we will have 12 bytes of space for the first one. And the second one, so this is a pointer which basically stores an address, and assuming that the address is 64 bytes, actually, it has space for only like it has only 8 bytes of space allocated for A2 because that's what it has inside it, the address of the of some memory space, and that address points to some space in the memory which is supposed to store an integer, but that actually we haven't allocated that one yet. The size of A2 is just the size of the pointer, which is the size of the size we need to keep memory address. So let's try the same thing again. So first one here is very similar to A1 that we saw in the last slide. It's an array of integers and it has three elements. But the second one, it's actually a pointer, but it's pointing to an array of three elements. So I guess let's see the figures. So the first one, it's actually the same as the before. What's the difference between A2 here? A2 is an array of three elements, but it's an array of pointers. So each element here stores an address, and that address is supposed to store an integer, which we haven't allocated yet. So the gray part here is the unallocated part. So that's why if we want to know the size of A2, that's basically the size of this yellow part, which is three elements, each containing one address, assuming each address is 8 byte, it requires 24 bytes. Now let's take a look at the third one. Third one is integer pointer a tree, and then we have three elements of that thing. Basically, what it says that, so because of the parentheses is surrounded, it's holding a tree, which is a pointer. Basically, a tree is again just one variable which is storing the address of some memory space. And the address that it points to, we are saying by this tree that it will point to an array of integer with three elements. Now we can say that, okay, what happens if we put the parentheses in some other place? What will happen if it's at the outside? And basically, if we put the parentheses at the outside, it doesn't actually affect that much. So it's basically the same thing as A2. So A2 and A4, they are basically an array of pointers, and each entry of that array is pointing to an integer. So that's why the size of A1 is size of three integers, size of A2 and A4 is size of three addresses, and size of A3 is just the size of this one pointer. Any question here? No? Yes.
So we talked about something about decaying arrays to a pointer.
Declaring an array to a pointer.
When an array decays to a pointer.
When you're using bracket syntax in an expression out of the language.
So the equivalence between array and pointer, I guess,
yes.
That's what you're asking. Okay, that actually leads to our next slide. So let's assume we have declared an array of integer, and we have 100, the size is 100, so there are 100 integers in that array. And we have declared a pointer, which is an integer pointer. So if we say that we assign this array to this pointer, that essentially is meaning that we have a pointer which is pointing to this this array. So this is actually a valid operation. You could do that. And look at the notion, the notation here, that just saying array is actually saying that we are assigning the address of the first element to the pointer. So if we say ampersand array element 0, that means the same thing as just writing array. But the reverse is actually not legal. So we cannot assign a pointer to an array. And why is that? Like, think about, like, this is our array and it has some elements. And the pointer is just one address value there, memory address value. So it's like you can see that these are not too comfortable. It's just not possible to point this one to this. So we can always point to an array using a pointer, but we cannot assign a pointer to an array. Any question here? No? Okay. So basically, this I'm showing again how to calculate the size. So if we say size of array, that actually would give us the size of the whole array, all the elements together. And because it's an integer array with 100 elements, this will say the size is 400 bytes. But if we say that what is the size of the pointer, essentially we are getting the size of the address. So what do you think we will get if we say size of ampersand array address 0? Anyone? Yes. So basically saying ampersand array 0 says it's the first element and it will just give us the size of the address. So now we would actually take a look at how we can use manpage in Linux. So you will use a lot of command line things while you are doing your assignment. So we want to make sure that you know how to look up things when you exactly do not know some specific command or how to use it. Like I myself, I don't know all the commands or all the options that comes with the command. So how we can do that? So if we type man is short for manual, we can actually look up some commands in our shell. So for the starter, let's just look up man and what does it say. So it just says that it formats and displays the online manual pages. And you can see it says how we can use the options, what each option means, what kind of argument they take. These are the description of the options. And usually, I guess it comes with some example. So for example, let's try to look at one specific command, ch. More. So I type it and here. So this command changes file modes or access control list. And you can see that here it has listed all the options. We can see what each specific option means. And then there should be some examples on how to use it. So here, if you type example, you will see. So I guess I already showed you this, the man page for changing modes. So now let's see how we can actually use this. So after chmod, we can have this option, dash dash recursive. Basically, it says that whatever mode we are changing, we want to apply it recursively. If there are some nested directories in the directory that we are trying to, we are handling, we want to consistently change the permissions. The last argument is the folder that we want to change permission. But let's see what does this OG minus R means. So basically this OG stands for others and groups. So your group is student. So if you're using your lab machines, you may actually have to use this command. So here, what OG minus R says that do something for users and groups. And what is the thing we want to do? The dext minus sign means that remove the permissions from others and group. If we had said OG plus something, that would mean that add this permission to these groups. And then we would write what are the permissions. So the permissions could be read, R stands for read, W stands for write, and X stands for execute. So by OG minus R, what this command would do is it will remove the read permission from others and group. So if it's your home directory and if you use it in your lab machine, it will make sure that no one else no other student in your group or any other user in the system can actually read your data. And I guess make sure your directory is actually not readable by others. If you download some files for the assignments, it may happen that the execute permission is not set. So what you want to do is you want to, when you download the files in your laptop or desktop, make sure to use this permission chmod to give yourself execute permission. So if I type ls, it gives me the list of all the files in this folder and some specific information. So if you look at this part, basically it says that this is a directory. The first three one is the permission related to yourself. So I have read, write, execute permission. But the group and the other, they don't have write permission, but they have read permission. So when you download some file, sometimes you may find that you cannot execute your file at that time. Just use chmod to change the permission. Any question? Yes.
User?
Yeah. User is yourself. Any question? Okay. So next, another command that you may have to use is tar. So basically, it's a utility to create archive files. And this is a very old command, so that's why it can actually take files as input or tapes. But nowadays, we don't have tapes anymore, so we mostly use it for files. So if you want to know what are the files that we have in your tar files, you have to write tar tf file name. So T here stands for a table of contents, so it will give you a list of all the files. And F here stands for file. So default is tape, which we don't use anymore. Whenever we are dealing with file, we have to give the file. If you want to extract that tar file, you need to write tar xvf filename. So here x is standing for extract, v is standing for verbose. So basically, it means that if there is some output, it will show you. So it will show you what it's doing while executing the command. Verbose is actually a common option with many of the command line arguments. But you can also use this tar command to create a tar file. And the format here is you write tar, then you specify CVF. C is for create, V verbose, and F is for file. And then the next argument is the name of the tar file that you want. And the last argument is the directory that you actually want to create a tar. Any questions? So actually, I don't think it uses any compression. If you want to use compression, you have to use bzip. So then so instead of tar, you will either have .gz or mostly .gz. But I think the files that we'll get for your assignment are all in tar, or they have
usually in tar.
Okay.
But the way tar works with compression is you compress after you run out, unlike zip, which there is an option to the tar command to create a compressed archive, but it wouldn't be called, you shouldn't call it .tar. You probably can, shouldn't, because then people won't know how to discern.
So yeah, I guess if you are doing something for yourself and you want to compress it, just use GC. And if there is anyone who doesn't know what is GZIP, you have the man page. Okay. So the next thing we want to talk about is how to input and output in C. So the assignment that you do next is in C, not in C++. And in C, we don't have IOStream, which we use in C++ for input and output. Instead, we have stdio. And I guess let's just take a look at the man, what it does. So this is the standard library for input-output in C. And it has std in, std out, and the std error is for error messages. And I think there is an example. Okay, I guess there is an example. But it's showing you all the functions that are included in stdio. So these are all file operations. But then we also have other display operation. So here is, where is printf? So printf is the one we will mostly use for input output. So I guess this is what I already showed. So this is just a screenshot if we type man stdio. And these are some of the functions. So we are particularly interested in printf. At C++, we use cout to print something, and print something at the display. And the format is cout, then whatever string that we want to print, and the name of the variables. So if we have two variables, customer number and customer name, then if we just put those variables in C++, we get them in the display. But here in C, in printf, we actually have to do something extra. We actually have to give a formatting option so that the printf knows what kind of variable it would print out in your display. So for example, customer number, it's an integer, and we actually have to put this person D to indicate that it's an integer number that we are expecting. For name, this is a character, a string of character, and we have to put %s to print a string. So the most common formatting options, I guess I have put here, but you can look at the man page for a full list of the displaying options. So let's start with the first one. So the first one I already showed you, this is %s, basically anything in string. Then suppose you are debugging and you want to know the address of some pointer. That we will do using %p. It will give us the address of that variable in hexadecimal. Then we have a bunch of options for integers and shorts. So if we say %d, we are saying that print it out in decimal. If we say %x, it means that print it out in hexadecimal. But if we want to print something in unsigned, unsigned int, unsigned short, unsigned character, we use %u. So you can see for %d and u, this is in decimal, but once we use %x, this is a hexadecimal number. Yes.
So about the sign, does it convert the 2's complement to unsigned first, or does it take whatever is encoded as the integer and interpret it as a truth?
So if you declare the variable as unsigned, you have to put %u. But there are sometimes we may declare an integer as signed and then %u, then the formats don't match, right? So in that case, sometimes the compiler actually typecasts it, but sometimes it may not. So you will see weird things happening. So do you want to add anything?
It almost always works in practice. Mm-hmm. I think it's guaranteed, but I'm not actually sure. When in doubt, typecast. It expects it on time. I think it's guaranteed to do the right thing if it's the same as signed and unsigned. If it's not, I'm not sure that the compiler is actually required to produce the result you expect. Even though logically there's nothing you expect to happen to prevent that.
So I guess it's just better to match the formats. So the next one is long. Basically, you just have to put L before D to print anything if you have declared the variable is long. Then for floating point numbers, we have a bunch of options again. %f will print it out with point. %e will print it out in scientific format. And %g is basically the compiler can choose to make it pretty. Sometimes if the number is too short, too long, it may use the scientific format. Sometimes it may not. Then you can ask, okay, what if I want to print %? So in that case, you actually have to use two of them. And so these are things we mostly use, but there are actually a lot of options. So if you want to know what are the exact displaying options with printf, what I have told you earlier, you're supposed to print type man printf. But unfortunately, this printf is not the C printf that we are looking for. So this is just printf that we could use in the command line. So this is not the one we want to look at. What we want is man 3 printf. So this is the right one. And I guess, so printf is actually a gazillion of options. You can look at the example, you can look at exactly what each option does. Sometimes you want to print out a floating point number with specific number of digits before or after the point. You can actually do all these things using this formatting option. Any question here? Yes.
For the man-to-man, if you put that 3 there, can you find a manual entry for any of the things in standard IO? Because the 3 required.
The 3 is required in, okay, so if there are multiple entries with something, so for example, it was printf, right? So we found that there is another command with printf, and then there is steady IO. Basically, they have different entries for those, and I just know that the steady IO is in 3, but it won't be all the in all cases. So you can actually find it out by where do I see it actually?
The way I usually find it out is running man space minus A for all. That, it shows you that, mm-hmm. You print out of this. And you can see at the top corner it says printf1, which means this is man1 printf, q, the exit.
You want to
do usually that man minus A will show you, mm-hmm. when you quit the first man page, it will show you all the man pages with that name. Sorry, it's happening.
Okay. And always you have the Google, you can Google it. It will actually show you everything you need to know. I guess any question? So next we want to talk about structures and dynamic allocation. So have you used structures before? Okay, some of the people. So basically structure is more like we are allocating a contiguous memory space for multiple variable, and we want to use that space or that structure as just one variable. So here I have said that I want to declare a structure which has an array of integer, and then it has a pointer to the same type of structure. And basically what struct do is it actually allocates the space for A, which is an array, and then it allocates the space for the pointer so that it can store the address. So I guess in C++ you have used class, so you can think about it somewhat like a class, but in C we don't have the notion of class.
There's no methods.
Yeah.
No
students. So okay, yeah.
A legal thing, and everything's always public.
So with structures, what you could eventually do is you can just declare a bunch of variables within that structure, and we could use them for different purposes. But I guess let's see how we could actually use them in our program. So this is a very simple structure. I declared struct rational, and it has 2 integers in the structure. So now this is a new type that I have declared, and I want to have a variable which has the type of the struct. And in order to do that, I have to write struct rational, and then I gave the name of my struct. And then it's kind of what you expect. I could reference the variables within the structure, assign values, do something with those values. Similarly, if I actually want to declare a pointer of that structure, I have to write struct, rational, and then the pointer. So whenever we are trying to use this structure, we actually have to say struct, rational, and then the name of the value. So sometimes you may not want to write it all the time, so there is actually a way to get rid of the writing struct every time. So that's what we could do using type definition. So in the top, suppose I have some other name, some really long name for my structure, And afterward, I can say that I am defining this longer name as rational. After we have the type definition, now actually we don't have to write struct rational and then the name of the variable. So then we can just write it rational and name. So here I write rational and the name of the pointer. So before, the syntax is we write struct, then the name of the structure, and then name of the variable. But if we do type definition, now think about it's like int. Instead of rational, it could have been just an int or double, and we could use it at the same way. So we write int 2.5, we could write rational 2.5. We have just defined a new type of variable. Any question here? It feels like you have a question. Okay. So the difference here is we got rid of writing struct all the time by using this type definition. The type definition says that struct, the name is now its shorthand, and the shorthand is now rational. Clear? Okay. So this is the way I, yes.
Why do you need that if you don't have more than one name for the same thing?
More than one name?
Oh, no, no, actually, so much.
So with type div, it's now the type is very similar to any other type, int, double, float. We would have written int 2.5, we could write rational 2.5. We could have written integer pointer p, now we can write rational pointer p. So sometimes you actually may see this whole thing written in a shorter way. Instead of writing a separate type div definition, we can just start with type div, structure, other name for rational, declare the structure, and then put the name here. So this is also a valid way to define the structure. And sometimes this is also a way people use. So we have just got rid of the bigger name, and we are defining that this is the structure and its definition is rational. Any questions? The middle one creates an instance of the structure.
And the bottom one just defines what rational
is. No, I think with type div, we still haven't actually defined. We have declared the type rational, but we haven't actually have anything yet. So it's like we have said we will use it as int, but it means that we have int, but we haven't assigned a variable to that. So we have to say int x. So if we say rational x, then means that we have allocated. We are trying to allocate something.
Why would you ever have like name something other than rational? Trying to find rational. Why would you ever have the other name for rational there? What was the point there?
What was the point there? I actually don't know. Do you know?
I think the next slide.
I don't have that.
When we do linguists,
yes. Okay. Yeah, I guess we will see. Let's hold on to that question. So why do we need to have this name if we actually could have just avoided and put it at the end? Yes, we will answer that. So, let's hold on that question for a minute. So the next thing we should know is structures are, in general, they are not references. They're like variables. Anything you do, like the way you declare a variable, you should use it that way. So for example, here, I have a structure called triple, and then I have two variables for triple. One is foo and one is bar. So for foo, I assign some values to it. So that means that now we have some space in our memory which is containing A, B, C, and because we are assigning 3, all of these variables, they have the value 3. Then what we are doing is we are assigning foo to bar, which basically means that we are copying the values of foo to bar. So bar has its own space where we are taking the values of foo and copying it there. Now if we change bar, it will change only bar and not foo. So when I say bar dot a equal to 4, only the a of bar would change the value, not the foo. And again, this is very similar to how we use any other data types. So if I say integer x and assign value 3, then I say integer y equal to x. That means that I copy the value of x and assign it to y. If I change y afterwards, only y changes, not x. Is that clear? So if you actually want to have a pointer of the structure, you actually have to say triple pointer bar and then assign the address of foo to bar. But when we are just working with structures as variables, they are like any other variable. Any question? I guess, yeah. So here, what I'm doing is I'm trying to define a type for list. And list has two entries here. It has an integer item, and it has a pointer to the structure that we are defining. So this is where the answer is. So first, I say type def struct list t. So this is our longer name. Then first item, then and next I want to add the pointer. And it's a self pointer, but I haven't actually finished declaring the structure yet, but I need a name. So that's why we have these lists. We will use list t here and say that the pointer next, the type of the pointer next is struct list t. So then we end the structure and then we have the short name. Okay. I guess, so by the type definition, we have the type, but we actually don't have any space for it, right? So we actually have to allocate some space if we want to use this entry. So suppose I have a pointer which has the type of list. So list pointer head, basically it means that we have a space which contains an address. But that address is supposed to point to my entry list. To allocate that space, what we will write is malloc and then size of list. So that means that now on the heap I have space for structure list, which has an item and which has a pointer to point another item in my linked list. But this is still null, it means that it's not pointing to anything yet. Another thing we should always remember that if we use malloc, we are supposed to free that space that we have allocated after we are done. And free is just we use the name of the variable in parentheses. So the similar function calls in C++ would be new and malloc, new and delete. So instead of malloc in C++, we just write new list. Instead of free head in C++, we have written delete list. Any question? So how can we allocate dynamic array in C? And this is again related to using how using malloc and free. If we had a static array and we knew the size of the array, we could have just written array, and in brace we could have just say 10, 100, whatever it is. But if we want to create it dynamically, then we need to use malloc. So here, if I want to allocate an array which has 100 integers, what we need to say is we have to say what's the size of each element. Element here is an integer. And then say that because we want to allocate 100 entries, multiply by 100. So this is equivalent to writing new int 100. And after that, we can actually use the array as we used to do. Here, if we want to index the element I, we would just write array I, and then we could assign some value to it. So if we want to visualize it, this is our pointer, which is basically storing an address. And that address is pointing to an array of integer. So because we said we want 100 elements, we get 400 bytes, as each integer is 4 bytes and we have 100 of them. So malloc makes sure that we have this space allocated in the heap for array. But again, remember, once we are done with whatever we are doing, we actually free the array. And this is very similar to the delete function, how we use delete in C++. Any question? So next we will talk about some of the undefined behavior that we could see in our programs. And the one particularly we will talk about is what happens with signed and unsigned number. Just for a refresher, if we say signed, signed int or int, the values could be some maximum, some highest maximum number to some lowest negative number. For unsigned, it is always positive number. So for example, here is a code segment where we are doing signed and unsigned comparison. So int x has the value minus 1, so it has a signed value. But then we declared int y, which is unsigned, and it has the value of 0. In printf, we want to know if x is less than y or not. So if x is less than y, if it's true, the printf is supposed to print 1 because it's a true statement. And looking at the values, you would think that this is a true statement and printf should print 1. But you actually may get 0 because when we are comparing these two numbers, we haven't typecasted it. We are comparing integer, signed integer and unsigned integer. And Compiler usually converts them to same type in the beginning. So if you want to avoid any kind of undefined behavior with signed and unsigned, either typecast them so that you know what's the expected behavior, or I guess remember the rules and what the compiler does. Any question? So I guess let's skip this. So this is another example. So here we have a function called test, and it's taking an integer, a signed integer number as an argument, and then it's comparing what's the value of what is the grade of, it's comparing two numbers, number plus one and number. And it will return one if number plus one is greater than number. And in our common sense, number plus one is should be always greater than number, so it should always return one. However, let's actually be careful about the corner cases. Suppose I call this function, and in the argument, I use the highest possible integer number that we have. So remember that that's a positive value, and that's the highest value we could represent with a signed integer. What do you think would be the output of this printf statement? So who thinks it will be zero? Okay, and who thinks it will be one? Okay, only one person thinks it will be one. So actually, you could get both of those results because this is something which is not clearly defined. Depending on the compiler you're using and what kind of optimizing it's enabling, you could get zero or one. So why is that? So for example, this could be one of the optimized code. And you can see that, so this is test, and this is the return value of this function. The return value is usually in register EAX. And there is actually no comparison here at all. Compiler was clever enough, and it saw that the statement has number in both sides, so it just ignored it and assumed that it would be always true. So in the optimized version, it is actually always returning one. And in the less optimized version, it is actually going through the comparison and setting the EAX register. So basically, when we are dealing with signed and unsigned numbers, the behavior is not defined, and the person who wrote the compiler has the freedom to do what that person thinks is the right thing to do. So it could do whatever you expect it to do. It could crash your program, or it could just give the wrong result, which was in the last case. So the common type of cases where we could have these undefined behavior is when we have a signed integer overflow or underflow. That was the last case. But if it's unsigned, usually the behavior is defined.
Not usually. It is always well defined for unsigned.
Okay.
Which is why this is most confusing for people.
So only if you're using signed values, it's not defined. So be careful about how you use it. Then if we have some pointers, and it's accessing a region where it's out of bound, it's not clearly defined what you would get. Then dividing by zero is not defined. If you try to write a data which has been declared is read-only, that something is not defined. So these are the cases you should be careful how you use it, yes.
Did you read the thing you said earlier, it is defined for signed and it's not defined for unsigned?
it is defined for unsigned, it is not defined for signed. I don't think this is something we will ask in the exams, but this is something you may encounter in your labs when you're trying to do your assignments. So when you're mixing signed and unsigned, make sure you actually typecast and know what is the exact behavior you're trying to get. When you're doing some arithmetic with signed, think about what will happen if you have underflow or overflow. Any questions? Yes.
Was example one of undefined behavior sentence, mm-hmm. was that supposed to be because of comparing unsigned to signed things, or is it just because of signed interest having undefined overflow?
So this one. This one is, it's just not defined what happens when signed values overflow or underflow. Because here, number plus one and number both are signed values. And the one before we saw, so this is where we are comparing signed and unsigned numbers, which I think just to be sure what you expect from your code, typecast it. Compiler, otherwise compiler would typecast by itself. So. And if you find in your code that something is giving you weird answer, think about these cases if you have made any of those mistakes. Any question? Okay, so we will start a bit about instruction set architecture, but mainly we will continue it in the next class and we will introduce the toy instruction set architecture that we will read throughout this semester. So what is instruction set architecture, or ISA? So it's a grid upon interface between software and hardware. If our software assumes some guarantees from our hardware, and hardware is supposed to provide that kind of functionalities. And ISA defines how to communicate those assumptions. So ISA is the interface which sits in between hardware and software. And whatever beneath ISA is everything in hardware. And many of those things may not be exposed to the programmer. As a programmer writing a code, I may not know what's exactly going in the microarchitecture. But if I want the hardware to do something, this ISA would tell me how to instruct the hardware to do that stuff. Within the hardware, how it's implemented, that may be something we may not know because it's just hidden from the software. So microarchitecture is specific implementation of ISA. So for example, maybe we have an add instruction. So ISA would say that how that add instruction what would be the format of that add instruction, how many arguments it should take, what type of argument, and etc. But how that add itself is implemented in the hardware, that would be the part of microarchitecture. So for example, I guess we could think about cars. So in cars, we have brakes and we have gas pedal. And that's the interface between the user who is driving the car and the hardware that's in the car. If I want to accelerate, the interface, which is the ISA of the car, says that I have to press the pedal. But within the car, how this action results into accelerating, that something is not exposed to the driver. The only thing driver can do is it can press the pedal and instruct the car to accelerate. So similarly, in computers, IC is the interface between the programmers and the hardware, and we can instruct the hardware to do something based on the IC. So I guess I gave an example of add instruction. So add, basically the IC would say that this is my add instruction and maybe it takes two operands. But within the hardware, we could have many implementation of add. I don't know if you have read any of these, like bit serial, carry ahead loop. No, okay. So basically these are different ways we could add. Bit serial means that if I have values which have 4 bits, I will add each bit first, then take the carry and add it to the next bit and next and next. So the way we do add in if we are doing it by hand. But then there are some optimized implementation we could use. But these are not the things that is exposed to the system. The ISA only say that if the user wants to add two variables, it's supposed to say add and then give us some the variables in the numbers in some specific format. So ISA defines a lot of things other than the instruction. So basically instruction is a major part of the ISA. It says that what's the code that will represent some instruction, what are the parameters, how many registers we have in our machines, how we should access our memory. But it also have all these agreement on how system level things work, how the interrupt should be handled, how I/O should be handled, task management, power management. But in the course, we will actually mostly focus on this part. But if you want to know what's in the existing ISAs, you can look up the manuals. And actually, these are books with many pages. And you'll see that they define everything that you can think of based on these things. So currently we have multiple ISAs. For example, x86 is the one that usually is very prominent for Intel machines. If you have any Spark or I guess Power machines, that has a different contract. So think about it, like basically it's an agreement between hardware and software, and the software is telling the hardware to do something. So similar to languages, we could just come up with different kind of formatting, and essentially we have different companies use their own ISAs. I guess if you are using some low power device, you may have ARM in your iPhones, or I don't know, maybe they used to use Intel at some point. Then I guess these are kind of old ones. So this is something I skipped. So there are only few ISAs, like x86, Spark, MIPS, etc. But the microarchitecture, how it's implemented, it actually is different for every generation, every vendor. Intel machines like Itanium doesn't look like Nehalem or anything you can think of. So the ISA, it actually doesn't change as fast as we change the microarchitecture. And that's because it's an agreed upon interface between all the applications and the hardware. So suppose I wrote a program. It compiles to x86 machines. Then I gave a startup, maybe that's that code is now being deployed in many users. But if I change the ISA, I actually have to rewrite it and recompile it for the new ISA, and all the user that has been using that code, they won't be able to use that code anymore. In order to provide support for legacy code, usually we don't want to use the ISA that much. We try to keep the interface fixed mostly, and usually we change things on in the hardware where things are not exposed to the user. So what are the things that are in the microarchitecture? These are some of the things you will eventually cover in our course, so I wouldn't actually go into it, but we will actually read a bunch of these things. The main thing that today I want to talk about is how should we design the ISA, or why some ISAs look the way they look right now. So in the very high level, we have all these programming languages like C, Java, C++, C#, etc., right? And then there is this ISA, which is very close to the hardware. So the gap between this high-level language and the ISA is called the semantic gap. And the ISA could be placed very close to the high-level language, or it could be placed very close to the hardware. So based on where it is placed, we have come up with two kind of instruction set architecture. So if the instruction set architecture is very similar to high-level language that we use, like C or Java, it's called complex instruction set computer. And if it's more close to the hardware and more simple, we call it reduced instruction set computer. So what would be an example? For example, I'm trying to write a program which does quick sort, and I'm trying to write it in C. What are the options you could use? You could actually write a bunch of code which compares things and put things in places. There are some libraries which provides you some sort functions. You can also use that. So that's the high level language that we have. So my ISA, if it's CISC, I actually can say that it would be very similar to high level language I have. And one of the CISC instruction could be just quicksort. And this is not something I'm making up. There was a machine called VAX, which used to have these complex instruction set architecture. And actually, it had this instruction called quicksort. So you write quicksort, and the hardware does all the sorting for you. You don't even have to write all the instruction within the quicksort. You want to say something? Yeah, okay. Or you could say that like VAX actually had an instruction which could check the bounds of an array. So suppose I have I have three-dimensional array, and I access the array as A, then I, J, K. If you write C code and you get out of bound, C wouldn't prevent it. But VAX actually had this instruction where you can write A, I, J, K, and it will check the bounds, and if there is an error, it will give you an error. So the instruction set for complex CISC computers or CISC ISA, they were very close to these hard high-level languages. But on the opposite side, we could have very simple instruction, which usually we use nowadays. For example, move, or I guess add or multiply. So that's the another extreme end where the instructions are very simple, and that's what calls reduced instruction set computers. So what are the trade-offs? So we have these two kind of instruction set architectures, and there have been machines of both kinds, but how we could know which one is better in what way? So for CISC, like the complex instruction, it's actually very close to high-level language, so it's easier for the programmers to use it, or the compiler to use it. The compiler doesn't have to do much work if we are using a complex instruction set architecture. But then the hardware has to do a lot of work. If I say, like, hardware, do my quicksort, the designer that's designing that circuit, they have to do a lot of work to make sure that it works. But on the other hand, if I use the reduced instruction set architecture, which is like add, move, multiply, or very simple things. So then what the hardware designers have to do is very simple. They only have to design some ALUs which could multiply and add and move things around. But the compiler actually now needs to do a lot of work, because at the high level language, whatever we have written, compiler have to take it and convert it to these reduced instruction set instructions. But now compiler also have a lot of opportunity to optimize code. With RISC, the reduced instruction set architecture, the optimization burden is on the compiler, and for the CISC, the optimization burden is on the hardware architect. So I guess I was talking about some of the instruction in VAX machine. So if you actually want to know what instructions they had, you can take a look at their manual, which is VAX 11718. So find first, it actually would, so if you just had written the instruction find first, it will find the first set bit in a bit field. So think about even in C how you could do that. C doesn't do bit operation that well, so you actually have to do a bunch of XORs and ANDs to find out where the first set bit is. But VAX provided a way to do it in just one instruction. Then linked list. You will do the list assignment next and figure out how difficult using pointers could be if you don't use it properly. But VAX had all these enqueue and dequeue operation within the instruction set, which would have done it by in the hardware. And there is a bunch of other things. I didn't put poly. Poly was actually, you could take polynomial of some equation, and that there was just one instruction to do that. So I guess let's look at the trade-off again. So this is one x86 instruction, which moves a string from source to destination. So repeat move s, basically move a string from one place to another. So you could use this instruction, or you could use the RISC instruction set and do a bunch of move, add, compare to do it in iteration. Which one do you think is easy to optimize? You said something, right?
for the hardware side, risk?
For the hardware side, risk?
For compiler side. Mm-hmm.
No, I think it's the other way around, right? So compiler, if the only thing compiler had is one instruction, like there is nothing to optimize for the compiler. But if compiler have multiple instructions and it's going on, so suppose there are 10 characters in my string, then it could actually move all the memory instruction in the beginning so that the memory is accessed first, and in a pipeline manner, and then try to do the operations so that communication and computation is done in parallel or overlap. So it's much easier for the compiler if it's RISC, but if it's CISC, I guess the hardware is supposed to do the optimization. Yes.
Wouldn't it be easier for the compiler for the left one because it has to do less work to find the most intricate? There is only one thing for it to do, whereas on the right side, it has to find
multiple choices. Yes. So it's true that compiler has to do more, but it has the opportunity to optimize things. Okay. If it, there is just one thing, one operation it could do, eventually in the hardware there is no control how you're doing stuff. So maybe this operation is waiting for memory for a long time, but because compiler has no way to reorder things, it can't do anything about it. But
yeah, I guess another thing is sometimes it turns out that these single instructions are slower than other things you could do.
So suppose the hardware architect who designed it, he didn't do a good job. So in that case, it could happen that this is really, really, really slow, where if you had done it in the compiler, you could have got a very fast performance. And actually, it had happened. I guess we will talk about that in the next class.